From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells. In December of 2019, a cluster of patients was found in Wuhan, China, with pneumonia from an unknown cause. While the majority of the cases are in China, the coronavirus has been found in countries all over the world, including the United States, where there have been 14 cases reported. Now, over 3,000 people in China have died from the coronavirus. And on Wednesday, yesterday alone, Al Jazeera reported that in Hubei, the province at the center of the escalating coronavirus outbreak, health officials reported 242 people died from the virus in one day. Joining us now is Tanya Lewis. She's the health and medicine editor at Scientific American. She's followed this story closely and written on it extensively. Tanya, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's really nice to have you. We've been looking forward to this conversation. There is a lot of information out on coronavirus. Some of it's accurate, some of it maybe not, and it's good to have someone that's researched this so carefully. My first question is, what are the trusted sources that we can go to get our information, and what sources should we stay away from?
So that's a great question. With any kind of outbreak like this, the first place or some of the best resources are places like the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which is the U.S. government agency that's tasked with kind of responding to these types of outbreaks. And they are really a great resource for finding accurate information about what the virus is, what people should be on the lookout for, but also really to just get a sense of perspective on the risk to American citizens right now, which is very low at the moment. So that would be my first recommendation. The World Health Organization also has some great information out there. But of course, you can go to any number of trusted news outlets to sort of find out the latest in layman's terms.
Sure. And I did not know that there was a basic number that you all calculate. I think it's called R-naught. And I was wondering if you could tell us about that and what does that number tell us and how do we use that number?
Yeah, absolutely. So R-naught it's called the basic reproduction number. And what it is a measure of how many people an infected person can spread the virus to in a population that's totally susceptible. It's basically just a measure that epidemiologists use to get a sense of how easily a virus can be transmitted. But this number can actually be influenced by many other factors, depending on what's going on in an outbreak. For example, once people hear about the outbreak, they might start to take protective measures, washing their hands, avoiding people who are sick, and that can influence the reproduction number. But right now, the basic reproduction number for this virus, experts have calculated it to be somewhere between 2 and 3, thereabouts. So that means that one infected person they think could infect up to, 2 to 3 people who have not already been exposed.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Tanya Lewis. She's a science and medicine editor at Scientific American. She has co-written an article titled, "Will the New Coronavirus Keep Spreading or Not? You Have to Know One Little Number." And that one little number is that R-naught, or I guess we would call it in this country R0, R-naught number. And you're saying that for the coronavirus, it's 2 to 3 is what has been.
Well, I mean, I thought there have been some higher estimates, but at this point, I think the consensus is that it's somewhere between 2 to 3. Although this, like I said, the number is somewhat subject to change depending on what's happening with containment efforts and other
right.
factors.
So it's about how transmissible the coronavirus is in a given population. And as you say, it could probably change on a daily basis, but lots of factors play into this. And just to put it into context, I read that the measles virus has a much higher potential for infecting new people for every one person infected, that R naught value is 12 to 18 with the measles, which is sort of telling us that there might be some good news surrounding the coronavirus. Is that correct to say?
Yeah, so that's definitely true. The measles is has a much higher R naught, and that's why it's always so important to get vaccinated against measles, because it is such a easily transmitted disease. But you know, the R naught is only sort of one number that scientists are interested in with an outbreak. There's also, of course, the case fatality rate, which is also a measure of, you know, how severe a disease is, and the R naught doesn't tell you anything about how serious the virus is if it infects a person. So I think what's concerning about the new virus, the reason that there's been so much attention is that it's just such a new virus, so we really just don't know yet how deadly it is, or how likely it is that if you get infected, you will go on and develop some of these really severe symptoms like pneumonia.
Can you tell us why it is called coronavirus?
Sure. So the word corona actually comes from a word for crown, which basically refers to the shape of the virus. It kind of resembles a crown, like the sun's corona. So that's where the name comes from. And the reason it's called a novel coronavirus is really because there are many other coronaviruses out there, like SARS, for example, or MERS, and even the common cold, in some cases, are caused by a coronavirus, obviously a different, milder version, but that's the reason.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe where the common cold can focus itself in the nose and the throat, this focuses itself in the lower respiratory tract, in the lungs, and that, of course, can lead to pneumonia. Is that correct?
Yeah, that seems to be the case. I mean, certainly true that with milder respiratory infections, it tends to infect the upper respiratory tract, like the nose and throat, whereas this virus it appears to be similar to the SARS virus, and that one infected receptors in the lower respiratory tract. So that's why we think it might be causing this more severe infection that leads to pneumonia and can be fatal.
Right. And I also read that if you are in a crowded room and somebody sneezes and they have measles, that droplet can travel as far as maybe 50 feet, and somebody could breathe that in, ingest it, and get the measles, where this dies, they believe, in a lot shorter distance, maybe 5 or 6 feet. Has that been tested?
So I'm actually not sure whether or not we know for sure how far this, you know, the droplets from this virus can spread. But we do think it's spread by droplets, and that's why it's, experts are saying, you know, if you're in a place that might be exposed to somebody with the virus, you want to be careful to cover your cough and wash your hands, because if you are within that radius, you could potentially be exposed. But yeah, we don't quite know. It does seem as though measles is probably, you know, more transmissible. But again, this virus has clearly infected lots of people, so it is something that experts are trying to understand better.
So, Tanya, this morning I heard on a report on NPR sort of an update to that, the cruise ship that no one will allow approach their country. They've now anchored off the coast of Cambodia, I believe. Apparently on that ship, no one yet has shown any signs or symptoms of coronavirus. It makes me wonder about the incubation period. What can you tell us about that?
So, yeah, so there's actually several cruise ships out there, so it's important to kind of distinguish among them. There is the one that's currently harbored off of Japan right now, and that's the one that has had so many cases of coronavirus. And that one, I believe, is still being quarantined. But like you mentioned, there was this other cruise ship which was sort of denied entry to many different ports and didn't have any confirmed cases of the virus. So I think it's really important to, you know, follow an evidence-based approach and not just, you know, make decisions out of fear and without any evidence backing them. So I guess the kind of key takeaway is some of these responses are probably going too far.
Exactly. But of course, there's so much fear surrounding it. So what does that tell us then about, you know, if you've got a bunch of people on a cruise ship, for example, and none of them have shown symptoms of the virus, how long do you have to keep them there until you know? And that would relate to the answer of, you know, how long the incubation period, if that's the right word to use.
We, as far as we know, most evidence points to the incubation period being less than or within 2 weeks, so 14 days. And that's why you're seeing these quarantines of, you know, American citizens coming back from Hubei province being quarantined for 14 days, because that seems to be the amount of time that it takes somebody, you know, up to 14 days to develop the virus, to develop an infection.
Tanya, there's a seasonality to many viruses, and I know flu and cold viruses tend to peak in the winter months, and then they die down with the warmer weather. Is there any hope that that this might be the case with this coronavirus?
Yeah, so that's definitely something that experts have speculated about. It's true that many respiratory viruses, like flu or colds, do tend to be seasonal. But I think, you know, it's still a bit early to know whether or not the coronavirus will follow that pattern. But it certainly seems to be something that experts are hoping for, because obviously it's become such a severe outbreak. So any, you know, thing that would help would be a good thing.
And I believe that, and I don't know if this is true, but if you have an immune system that's compromised, if you've had a lot of colds, maybe you've had pneumonia earlier in the year and your body's been fighting, then you're probably more susceptible to be able to get this than someone whose immune system is you know, on all, you know, firing on all cylinders. And that's not a very medical thing, but, you know, to say, but is the gist of that true?
Yeah, so it does seem that, you know, from what we can, you know, it is very early in the outbreak still, so it's hard to kind of make, you know, firm statements, but it is true that most of the deaths that have occurred seem to have been in people who were older or had underlying health conditions. There have been a few exceptions, but it's really hard to know at this point in the outbreak. But it does seem as though many people have had milder infections. And that's one of the big unknowns right now, is just how many people out there have the virus or, you know, but just are not being having that detected because they haven't come into a hospital, for example. Uh-huh. So, and just to reiterate, this is still, you know, it is a very, well, experts are taking it very seriously. It's still an incredibly low risk for Americans because there have only been 14 confirmed cases in the U.S., and most of those people or all of those people are in quarantine and being cared for and doing quite well. So I think at this point, you know, the seasonal flu is a much bigger concern in the U.S. But again, because this is a new virus, experts are taking it seriously.
Right. So, Tanya, an outbreak or a pandemic, as John started to ask about, you know, running its course. So there is a peak, and I've read some varying reports on that there may be a peak of coronavirus. But what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so this is tricky. I mean, because we just don't know for sure, you know, if we're catching all of the cases that are out there. It does seem, well, there have been some reports that maybe the number of cases has slowed down, but then just last night, I believe, we've heard that the Chinese authorities have a new definition for diagnosing the virus or diagnosing infection, and that has actually caused the numbers to jump up dramatically. So it's kind of unclear at this point exactly whether or not we're seeing a slowing of the outbreak or, mm-hmm. You know, it's just something we need to have more time to really be able to establish. So I would say it's too early to say whether there's been a peak.
Right. And as I read in Al Jazeera this morning, so yesterday it was something like 242 deaths in China, which was like doubled from the day before for that given day. And so, I don't know if that's when they changed the way that they reported it. It's all very... It's a little frustrating, I'm sure, from someone studying it or writing about it like you do, to get the real information out of China.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding is that the increase does partially reflect the new definition they're using for diagnosis, and part of the reason they changed the criteria for diagnosis is that they, you know, had been relying on these test kits to kind of confirm infection with the virus, but there's just been a shortage of kits, and I think there's been problems with accuracy in the testing. So they've moved to a broader definition just based on clinical symptoms and like CT scans of the lungs, for example, which, you know, in some ways might catch more cases, but it might also, we might be catching other types of respiratory infections. And counting them as coronavirus infections. So it's a bit hard to say whether or not the increase in cases is really reflective of the number of people that are sick or not, which is frustrating, as you say.
On February 2nd, the World Health Organization came out with a statement that I've never heard from that organization before. Maybe they've made similar statements in the past, but I've never heard it. They said that they're dubbing the new coronavirus a massive infodemic, referring to an overabundance of information, some accurate, some not, that makes it hard for people to find, you know, trustworthy sources, as we were speaking about earlier. And as much as social media has perpetuated the disinformation, it's also been really good for helping doctors whistleblow about the severity of the situation, getting the word out and that sort of thing. But the important thing, again, is to go to the trusted sources, the CDC or, you know, maybe some of the major media centers, that sort of thing. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, no, that's definitely important to know that there's a lot of information out there that may or may not be accurate. And it's good to just always, you know, look at the source and look at whether or not they're quoting an expert from a recognized agency, for example, you know, or whether it's just based on an unpublished report or study that hasn't been peer-reviewed, for example. So there really has just been a lot of information coming out, and it's important to just keep things in perspective and, you know, go to those trusted sources.
And I have to believe it would be a challenge for you, because when you're reporting on something in the medical field that is static, you know, there's no emergency or anything, and you're putting the information, your facts together, writing your story, rewriting your story. In this case, you're dealing with real time, or as real time as possible, information, and you've got to get your stories out right away. So it's probably tougher for you, right?
Yes, it's definitely a challenge. But, you know, that's kind of what we do as reporters. We just have to collect the facts, and as the facts might change, you have to be nimble and kind of respond to that. And we've seen that with this outbreak, where there's been speculation, for example, about what animal might have transmitted the virus to humans, and that has evolved over time. We still don't know for sure what the animal is, but there have been various reports out there, and we've had to kind of change our coverage to reflect the changing knowledge about the disease.
Right. So what you're referring to is, I think with SARS, MERS, and the coronavirus, a lot of times it's transmitted by bats. However, I read something about bats weren't present in this market where they believe that this version of the coronavirus first came about. Is that kind of how it goes?
Yeah, so it's correct that many coronaviruses, including SARS and MERS, are traditionally, we believe that bats are kind of the host animal, so the virus is able to replicate within the bat without infecting it or without sickening the animal. But in all of these outbreaks, it's become clear that there's usually an intermediate host or another animal that transmits the virus from bats to humans. So, for example, with SARS, that animal was thought to be the civet cat, which was an animal that is sometimes consumed, I believe, in China, and was found in some markets there. and had the virus. And then with MERS, there was it's thought to be transmitted by camels. Hmm. So although and this new virus, the coronavirus, the novel coronavirus, is also thought to exist in bats, as far as we can tell, but we don't know what that intermediate animal might be.
Mm, that's so interesting.
Some people have, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
There's been some speculation that it may be pangolins, which are those sort of anteaters that have scaly skin. And there was a study that came out a few days ago about that, just showing that this type of virus is often present in those animals. But again, you know, that's a preliminary study, and we just don't know for sure whether that animal was even in the markets or whether it could be another animal.
And could you talk to us about some recent headlines I've seen suggesting that we are becoming, as humans, more and more susceptible to the viruses that animals are carrying?
So I don't know for sure, you know, whether it's true that we're more vulnerable or whether we're just simply catching more of these types of outbreaks. It's certainly true that these are a threat, these types of zoonotic diseases that jump from animals to humans. And I think, you know, it's just a reminder that, you know, with such a global population, with so much international travel, something that jumps from animals to humans in one place can very quickly spread around the world. So it's just really important to understand the conditions in which this type of jump can occur and just be vigilant for these types of emergent viruses.
I don't have any scientific data to back this up, but just sort of based on anecdotal observation, it seems that people are much better about washing their hands and people are much better about sneezing into their shoulders and, you know, those sorts of things. I think that people become sensitive to some of the things that we need to do to protect ourselves. And again, that's just anecdotal.
Yes, I think people are more educated now. I mean, that's really the most important thing, to just kind of be aware of what steps you can take yourself to protect yourself against any respiratory illness, including the flu, because the best way to prevent you know, a major outbreak is to really just follow basic hygiene procedures. So I think wash your hands, you know, coughing into your elbow and staying home if you're feeling sick. Those are all just simple steps that people can take. And, you know, it's just really important in general for people to be careful.
Yeah. Tanya, before we let you go, what is your next story that you are working on? Maybe a story outside of coronavirus. What do you have in the pipeline?
Yeah, well, we've certainly been totally absorbed by coronavirus in the last couple of weeks. As always, I'm always working on a few different things. We've got a story on what we understand about Alzheimer's disease and what some of the most recent approaches to treating Alzheimer's are. And, you know, I'm on the lookout for more updates on the coronavirus, looking into some of the potential treatments that are being used, some of the antivirals that were used on previous diseases like Ebola and HIV, and trying to understand whether any of those treatments might be effective against the novel coronavirus, because there's clearly a need for better treatments or for any treatment at this point. And then also we're hoping to see the development of a vaccine at some point, although that's probably several months away at the earliest before that can even be tested. So we're just kind of keeping an eye on all of these things.
And Alzheimer's research is very exciting because there's a lot of people working on that. There's some money that's being funded. Lots of people working on it, the technologies, the collaboration, sharing of information. I'm hopeful that with the effort that people are making, organizations are making, that there will be some headway, and you'll be able to hopefully write a very positive article one day about this debilitating disease.
Yeah, we definitely all hope that would be the case someday, because it's been a very complicated disease to understand, and obviously there's a big impetus to develop a treatment that will actually help. So I know there are definitely lots of smart people out there working on it, and we'll just have to kind of see which approaches turn out to be effective, because
right.
there's a big need.
Tanya Lewis is the science and medical editor for Scientific American, and we want to thank you so much for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute. We'll be right back.